that ticking?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Gabe. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Gabe.
Really grateful to be here. And that's a compliment to be called infectious. I take it as one. I'd like to thank Sunday Nighters and Grant for having me come down here and share tonight. It is really like it's a privilege to come down and share at the group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And wow, I was talking earlier, and I remember coming into this room a little over 13 years ago, beaten and distraught, and it was Tuesday Beginners, and it was set up in that way, and I could give you a little kind of layout. My life has hit rock bottom once again, as it always did, and I went and sought help, and I went and I saw an ad in the Yellow Pages, and it was a therapist, and it said, you have financial problems, marital problems, problems with alcohol and drugs, and I said, come and see me. And I went and saw this lady, and she was right down the block. And I was, I went there, and, I still had a little bit of an edge to myself. And she said, what do you want from me? What can I help you with? And I said, I just don't want to drink. And I said, every time I drink, I don't know what's going to happen. I just don't want to drink. And she said, well, I think there's a place for you. And she said, it's Alcoholics Anonymous. So I said, okay, I was open to any ideas. That was on a Monday. And I went and saw her again on a Tuesday night, and we talked for about 30 minutes. And then she sent me down here. And I walked up. She's in Westmount. And I walked here, and I stood in the side of the doorway there, and a member was speaking right over there, and he was talking about top shelf sobriety, about how Alcoholics Anonymous and sobriety is like a buffet table. You got the cold cuts on the bottom, and you got the regular cut beef down there, and you got the prime at the top, and he wanted top shelf sobriety, and he was walking up and down, he was prancing over there, and he was giving his show, and I started to smile, but I hadn't come in because I had the door ajar a little bit, and light was coming in a little bit, so they asked me to close it, and I stood up at the side and still a little bit leery about coming in here and getting involved. And he was prancing back and forth, and people were laughing and smiling. And that was the first time I had smiled in months. And immediately I took to it, and they said, anybody want to, after the cheer and everything, they gave away a chip. And I came up and I got a chip. I know I took a chip because I had a chip. I still have that chip. And I know I took one, but I don't really remember walking up and taking one. I don't know if I mentioned my name or what have you. And after that, the meeting was over a little bit after that. And then everybody, a group of guys came and approached me. And, they gave me their number. And they said, if you want to go to a meeting, call me. I'll meet you another time. And the very next day, they took me to a meeting. They met me after work, members of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they met me at Plamondon Metro stop, and I got into the car, and they started driving me around. They said, okay, we're going to take you to a meeting in some Point St. Charles, and I'm from the States. I didn't know where the point was or what have you, and so they're driving me around the point, and these side streets, there's no lights or very little lighting, there's no traffic stop lights. There's a couple of stop signs, and they're looking around for another member's place. They're like, oh, look, where's Tara? I don't know, does she live here? Does she live there? And I'm starting to get nervous. This is only my second day of being in Alcoholics Anonymous. So, they stop in every second or third street. And in my head, I'm like, I'm going to get the hell out of this car, I don't know these guys from Jack Diddley's spot, So I'm like, all right. And then sure enough, they found the person who we were supposed to pick up. I think she jumped into the car, and we went to the meeting. And that's how my road to recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous started. I'm just going to go back very briefly and touch on my history. I was born in the Caribbean, and then I was raised, and my family, we migrated into, migrated, it's temporarily, into the States. We went into the States as I was a young child, and I was raised in Brooklyn, New York. I was raised in a Catholic household, I went to a private Catholic school for the first 8 years of my education. I have one older brother and four sisters. And I always share, that's the reason why I drank, because my four sisters, you know, she keeps me carrying. I won't make an amends meeting here, but it's just a joke. My sisters are tough. I love my sisters. I love my brother too, and I love my sisters to death. And we're pretty much tight, especially growing up in New York. You had to be a little bit tough, you know. We didn't lack for much growing up. We didn't have a lot. We weren't really poor. I like to say we were like poor middle class. That's my description of our economic standing there. And I grew up in a neighborhood that was very mixed. It was a melange, ethnically, religiously. Strangely enough, I grew up in Crown Heights. And there's like a religious Hasidic area, you know, in that area, Crown Heights. And it's Jewish, Hasidic, and it's funny, where I work now is the same Hasidic. Guys, like, I know it like the back of my hand, you know, and it's funny, I was at work yesterday morning, and I'm listening to the radio while I'm working, and they have this guy, he's a hit now in like reggae rap, and he's a religious Hasidic Jewish guy, and he's got like a big hit. And he's from Crown Heights. It's only out of Brooklyn you can get something like that, you know. So I grew up in a neighborhood like that. It was a little bit tough, you know. You have to like either fight for what you get, or be very quick in what you're getting, or you won't get, you know. So that's how I was raised, and I wasn't really the tough guy, but I think I could handle myself. I kind of had to handle myself growing up. And like I said, we didn't lack for anything. The neighborhood was kind of tough, but I don't know if that's the reason why I drank or started to drink. Like I said, my family is very close. We're not really the lovey-dovey type of family. You know, we're not going to sit down and say, I love you, but I think the love is shown and expressed in the way we treat each other. You know, and so anyway, went to school, things were fine. Growing up in that neighborhood and going to Catholic school was a blast. I loved going to school. I had two teachers I never forget in the first grade. One was Miss Violette, the other was Sister Colette. And I remember Miss Violette used to say, "Oh, Gabriel, my angel, you're so sweet, you're so nice." And she used to give me those little bunny stickers and, you know, the little sunshine smiley things. And then I would switch over and go to Sister Colette's class. She said, "You're the devil, you know, stand in the corner, put the gum on your forehead, you know, hold the Bible this way, you know." But it was okay, you know, it wasn't all right. Showing up didn't spare the rod when I was growing up. Not in school and not at home, you know. But I don't think that's the reason I drank. Also, I don't know if it's because of the collapse that I drank, but it was okay. I think I was all right, kind of adjusted as a child. And, you know, I was a little bit quiet, a little bit on the shy side. But when I had to speak, you had to speak, you know. Six kids in a household, you had to get what you had to say, you had to say it, right? And so my childhood was kind of all right. Nothing major happened there. And I played sports. I'm not a big guy, but I kind of excelled at sports. So I fit in a lot with my brother's friends. My brother's a little bit older, and they played sports. And I played well enough to fit in with them and hang out. I remember they would, after the games, they would drink some beer, smoke some weed, and they'd say, "Oh, you want some?" I'll be like, no, that's all right. That's okay. And I think like around 12 or 13 or so, like, I had drank before because I was raised in a Caribbean household, right? So we got like rum and alcohol is almost secondhand inside the home, accessible at least. But I think around the age of 12, you know, really drank with the intention to get drunk or like the guys to hang out. And if I remember well, I think I passed out and they carried me home. Was at a softball game in the back of the, you know, the school was locked up for the summer, and we used to like open up the fence, clip it a little bit, open up underneath, sneak under and play some pick-up softball. And I think I drank and I passed out and they like carried me home or something. That was one of many times that happened, you know. And needless to say, my drinking increased, and you know, not a little jackpot stories, and some of them are funny, you know. I know for my 17th birthday, I was out for like around a little over 24 hours. I had crashed And they took me home. I think they rang the bell, and I ended up downstairs in my room, and it was like a day afterwards I woke up, like complete, a little over 24 hours. I was just totally out. There's a lot of other jackpots. Incredible. Anytime I had any, like a minor arrest or anything like that, I was intoxicated. It came to a point where it was like the norm, you know. I used to drink. I thought that drinking it was fun. It was okay, and many times I had a good time with it. But on the flip side, it almost became like the thing that if I drink, I would either get sick or drink with the intention to get drunk. And it wasn't like, okay, let's sit down and have a couple. I think that's because when we started drinking back in my neighborhood, I think the idea of drinking was to get drunk. And like, we didn't start drinking like, hey, let's sit down and have a beer and have some fun and talk. It's like, hey, let's get wasted, you know? Like, so that's the way I started, and that's the way it kind of carried on through. My drinking increased, drugs got involved in there. I started smoking weed at a young age, and that increased a lot. And, you know, other things came into play, and I just, you know, life started to spiral out, you know? And then, you know, for me, what happened is, like, the more I kind of drank and the more I kind of smoked weed and the more I took myself away from reality, I started to isolate myself, sometimes physically, but not really so much physically as much as emotionally. And being, I'm looking at it now, like, I'm not this kind of guy, I'm not psychedelic, I ain't going to get into this emotional type of a thing, but looking at it, like, kind of isolating myself from my family and not involve myself in their lives as much as I could have while I was intoxicated and high. And so, of course, that started to affect them. I'm now starting to see that. And I was brought up in a neighborhood where, you know, you have to respect, like, the younger ones and respect the older kids. When I was a kid, you know, they used to take us to baseball games. The older guys, my moms and other parents, it would be like a group of us, a whole crew of us from the neighborhood. We would cut out, like, the back of milk cartons, and you get coupons, you get 10 of them, you get to the game free, and we all did that. We collected coupons, cut them, and we'd go up into the nosebleed section, trickle down, and hang out. And so that, you know, that's a passage, you know? So we had to do that for the younger ones. And, you know, I started taking care of the younger kids, playing, like, pick up sports with them, make sure they're doing okay. But when my drinking started to increase, and, you know, I just kind of disconnected from that. And then, you know, respecting the older people. If you were fall down drunk, you had to be respectful. I remember, like, some guys in my neighborhood and family, you know, some real tough guys, thugs or whatever, if you want to call them, they're good people to me. Some of them are doing heavy time or what have you. But no matter what they're doing, if my mother or my aunt would pass by, it would be, hello, Mrs. Knapp, how you doing? Hello, Auntie Lynn, how are you? And respectful, stop what they're doing and, you know, and keep themselves. And when they go, then we carry on, you know. But I started to forget about it, you know. I would come in all hours of the night, all hours of the day. I would be in and out. I remember one time I was coming home Monday morning, and a neighbor of mine, Jimmy, you know, he was coming in too. And he was older than me. He was older than my older brother. He was an ex-Vietnam vet and whatever. And he had troubles in his life, you know. And it was well documented. It was a really good guy, man. A heart of gold, but he did everything from fireman to mailman to nurse, and he couldn't get his stuff together. And I remember one time I came in from a bender, you know, I was coming in, I was turning my, you know, the lock, and I look over, and his house was about three houses over, and he was coming in, he just looked at me, and he shook his head, you know, and I was like, man, what is this guy shaking his head at me, you know, but I think that was that respect level I started to leave also. And that's the self-centeredness of it all, you know. So, you know, my drinking got out of control. Started getting to a lot of jackpots. And my friends started to back away from me, and I started to back away from them. These are guys that I grew up with as kids, you know, and we were very tight. Those were my closest friends, and they wouldn't hang out with me or drink with me. They didn't hang out with me, but the minute I started drinking, that was it. They just, like, cut out. And these guys, some of them, in my opinion, are like alcoholic or borderline alcoholics. And they started backing away. And I just got into all kind of jackpots. I got into harder drugs. And that took me down into a road that is indescribable almost. You can watch it on television. And people here who have problems with drugs, I guess, also. And with alcohol, too, you know, like, can identify with that. You go into the depths. We put ourselves into the depths of hell and into situations that, you know, you wouldn't wish on anybody else, probably. Like, and that's what happened. It was like a fast track to destruction. And I was like leading the way, you know, the conductor, choo-choo, going to hell, you know. And so my life was spiraling out of control, and I got into so much jackpots. Wow, man, I remember times I would be like, you know, at the young age of 19, I became a father, and my wife's a Montrealer, she's a Canadian, and she tried living in the States, it didn't work out for her for a little while, and she came up here, and I'll be trying to come up here like once a month or once every 6 weeks or so. And you know, I remember that scenario, you know, I'll be coming up with like food for my child and clothes, and I would go in a big, you know, the army duffel bag or what have you, and I'd get to Port Authority and my bus wouldn't be there as yet, and it'll be like, okay, you know, my bus is at 9, maybe I could take the 10 o'clock bus. That bus will leave me at 5 o'clock in the morning. I only have to wait X amount of time for the metro to start here. And, I have a drink. And then I'll go drinking, and then 10 o'clock will come. I'll be like, I can't get that bus. 11 o'clock is a little bit better. I get here at 6:30. Definitely could take the metro. I don't have to pay for a taxi. I can save money. And then 11 o'clock will come, and I'm all around somewhere, 42nd Street or somewhere on Broadway on 8th Avenue or somewhere. And 11 o'clock will come. I go, man, I'll just take the 12 o'clock bus. You know, it's express. It only has one stop. I'll get there the same amount of time. And, you know, 12 o'clock will come, and I'll be in, like, some, like, sleazy $15 motel room drinking and smoking with, like, who knows what and who. And I will never make it here. And it'll be, like, time and time again that would happen. I can never figure it out. You know, so many times I try to do that, not hang out with certain people, not walk down certain streets, give my money to my family, my sisters or something, you know, be more conscientious about church or something, focus more on work, and it wouldn't work. Somehow, somewhere, I will end up drunk, and I couldn't figure it out. You know? And actually, you know, I just, you know, life started to become so bleak, you know, and that's what happened with my drinking, my alcoholism, you know, and life started to become more and more bleak, and I just wanted to escape more and more. I mean, you know, I just, you know, I think I was the type of person that was uncomfortable and uneasy just that way many times, and I just tried to seek that ease and comfort. And if I couldn't get that ease and comfort, just want to escape. That's the whole deal, you know, and I couldn't get it. I just couldn't get it. After the first time I drank or did drugs, and that first initial feeling is after that, it's just an illusion. It's not real. So chasing that and, you know, the spiral and getting wrapped up in myself and, you know, led me into more or less into these rooms. I got here in 1989, and I never forget, I was taking that bus up here, and that twist, that mental twist in my head, I was like, man, I've never been to Albany. It's the capital of New York. I said, I bet you if I let my luggage and stuff stay on this bus, I can get in Montreal. I can just get out of, you know, that lie that we tell ourselves, eh? You know, like, just easy way. I was like a snake. I could just get out of such, you know, out of anything. And I held onto that chair. I never forget when I got to Albany, and I held onto that chair. I didn't even get up to get coffee, man. I just sat down, and I took the ride straight up here until I got to the, I think it was Blackpool, was the crossing or whatever, and I got out for that. And I got in, and I went there. And I've come up here many times. I've gotten taken off of Greyhound. I've gotten taken off of Amtrak. I've smoked weed in the middle of Amtrak and drank, knowing that by the time I get to the proper authorities at the crossing, I won't have anything, right? So I'm drinking that like a fool. And like I remember one time I was taking the Greyhound bus up there, and the guy next to me, big bearded guy, I was like, where are you going? He's going as far as he let me. And he had like some Jack Daniels. I was like, yeah? He goes, yeah, and I had like some blow or whatever and weed. I said, yeah. And he was like, he had a racist overtone to himself, you know? And I was like, I didn't even care because I didn't have no booze or whatever. I just had something to snort at. I said, I tell you what, you share that, I share this. He said, fine. And we just rolled up there, man. It was like, I don't know, Jekyll and Hyde or something like that. The odd couple, we're going at it, arguing, talking, and but you know, every second or so, I walk into the bathroom and come out, and those are some of the funny stories. And there's sad stories. You know, there's stories of me trying to, like, you know, standing up in the rain in Red Hook, an abandoned building. You know, just standing there for no reason. I had a home to go to. There's situations like in Bedford Stuyvesant. I'm there standing up, and You had heroin addicts more or less taking care of me, trying to get me to come down from rushing and racing. There's all kind of situations like that. And I think the ones that hurt is the looks, you know, that you get from the family and from people. Those things like stay in my mind. I remember one time I was coming from a 3-day bender. I was on the train. And it must have been 5 o'clock in the morning. This woman, she was Latino or whatever, with her daughter, sitting on the train. And I didn't want to sit there because I know I looked like garbage, intimidate them because we're the only ones on the train. So I sat at the other end of the cart. And they looked at me, they smiled just to be pleasant, smiled. And by the end of 3 or 4 stops, this woman was crying. She was just crying uncontrollably, man. Crying. And, you know, I only assume that I don't have psychic ability. I'm not Uri Geller or anything like that. But I assume she must have looked at me and had some kind of compassion or brought something to her mind. And these are the things that stick in my mind about my drinking and my using and hurting and harming people. Anyway, you know, I came to Montreal, I did well for a little while, and I hit the same jackpot, found the same places I did, and got into the same trouble. You know, I would drink and cause havoc, and the thing for me is I prided myself in always remembering things. I started to forget things, and I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I found out they call it blackouts, but, you know, I would argue with my wife. She said, oh, you said this, and you said that. And I said, oh, you're just jealous, and you're just lying. You don't want me to do that. And then her friends would tell me, yeah, this is what happened. You know, they would verify that this I did this, and I was, like, stunned, you know. And so, you know, my drinking increased. I got a job here, and I made a fool of myself for the Christmas dinner. I got there, like, drunk at 12 o'clock in the afternoon. I was drinking with the babysitter after I dropped off the kids, and I was just going to go to Benihana. You know, I was drunk within the span of an hour because I was just putting them back. You know, I've been in car accidents. And anyway, so I got in here, I got the same trouble here. And, you know, meanwhile, the wife and my kids, they're suffering, you know. And, of course, I'm not bonding with anybody because that's the way I am. So anybody I'm associated with in Canada is just either drinking buddies or using buddies or people I just, all my coworkers. And I hit my bottom in 1991, I went to another fellowship. I went to CA, and I couldn't get sober for 10 days at a time. And then they used to say, maybe he needs AA, maybe he needs the steps. I'd be like, what's AA? What's the steps? You know, like, and they said, don't worry, you know. And after going there for about 2 months, I had 10 days sobriety, and I went up and spoke in a meeting and tell them, God bless you, I love you, have a good Christmas, and I really appreciate things. And I never went back there. And for the next 2 or 3 months, I was sober off of everything. I didn't even smoke cigarettes. And I didn't do drugs. And I had caught a little bit of that. I didn't drink. I heard that was optional. I never did coke again in any form or fashion. And but in February of, that was 1991. February of 1992, it dawned on me my baby sister didn't get married. And how can I not be able to drink? Because we have good weddings there. The last wedding I remember we went to, I think we broke a few tables. It was great. I went to a wedding and from the church to the reception hall was about a 10-minute drive. We were plastered in 10 minutes. And by the time we got there, my uncle was like, my God, you just left the church. You look fine. It was me, I think the best man, and my sister's husband. We were wrecked by the time we got there. You know, it's just 10 minutes, you know. And so in my mind, my sister didn't get married. I have to be able to drink. So I started to drink again, slowly but surely. I was drinking wine. I despised wine. All the sweet liquors and stuff I didn't like, you know. Like, I preferred, like, vodka, gin, and stuff like that. But I started to drink wine again. And my wife would say, what happened to the wine? And I would say, I don't know what happened. She's like, it's only kids, me and you. Something had to happen, you know. And, you know, I wouldn't fess up to it. And started drinking again. And it started to spiral out of control once again. Got into trouble. I used to see members of AA in NDG. And I'd be walking with my kids. And I had my daughter pulling my son in the red wagon. I have a spliff in my hand, a Guinness stout in the other hand. In the middle of the day, I'll be walking down the street. I'll be seeing members. I say, hey, how you doing? They go, fine. I say, I'm doing fine. I'm okay, man. You want some? No. I say, it's not beer. It's not the beer. Smoke the weed. It's okay. And they'll shake my head. They'll shake their head and say, no, that's okay. That's all right. And when I got to my first, I had my last drunk in November of 1992. I continued to drink after my last drunk and could not get drunk for about 2 weeks. Life was bleak. I was remorseful, depressed, out of it. I felt like I was going nuts. I wasn't with my wife and my kids anymore. By the fine government of Canada, they said, don't contact, don't see them. And you know, and I basically knew nobody here. And I reached out for help, and I ended up in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my first meeting in Alcoholics Anonymous was here in this room. And like I spoke at the beginning, and I met these members, and Barry was here speaking, and he's giving his spiel, and people came up afterwards. And I saw some of the members from CA that was in AA that had seen me at the meetings there and saw me in the NDG. And they were like, we thought we'd see you here. You know, welcome back, you know, welcome back. And I felt good. And I got onto the AA board. And it was really simple for me at the beginning because, you know, coming over from New York, I had no real friends here except for people I drank with and used with. So I got involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't be with my wife or my kids. I remember I got a place to live in. It was close to my job. It was on DeCaria and Coast St. Catherine. It was like a drug den. This apartment building was like, you know, I got in there, it was like roaches, you know, and they had people drinking and using all day. My sponsor would come over. I would have meetings in there, you know. I never forget, I would have meetings once a week. I would have a big book study in there. People were like disgusted, you know what I mean? There was more roaches than anything. And people would knock on my door in the middle of the night asking for stuff. I don't know how I stayed sober, you know. But I got myself a sponsor. A guy asked me to sponsor him. Alvin asked me to sponsor him. And it was the funniest thing. I said, yeah, I sponsor you, no problem. And I started working the program as members in Alcoholics Anonymous was showing me to do, you know. And I taking him around the meetings, working the big book with him, you know, discussing things, doing steps. And he had no place to stay after a few months. And I brought him into my place, you know. I've been about 3 months sober, so I must have been about 4 months or 5 months sober. And I still wasn't all there when I was 4 or 5 months sober, eh? You know, so Alvin was shacking up with me, and it was like a one-room type of a place. And like, you know, we would break down the bed. I would sleep on the box spring, because I'm lighter. You guys know Alvin, he's like about 320. So he would take the mattress, you know? And he would sleep there, and I would sleep over here. But, you know, I still was kind of like imagining things, but I was sponsoring him still. So I would get up in the middle of the night, I would look across the street. I had those people just looking at me. And so I would call my sponsor and tell him, look, people are over there. And he said, what do you mean people are over there? I said, well, they're walking up and down. He goes, they live over there. I go, wow, they're looking at me. They want to do something. I'm going to go over there. And he's like, man, go to sleep. And I didn't notice Alvin would hear this. I thought he'd be sleeping. And he told me a little bit afterwards, he goes, man, he's a big guy, eh? This guy's like 6'5", 320. He goes, man, I was so afraid with you. He said, for the first couple months, I got no sleep. He said, every night I was over there, I slept with one eye. I was exhausted, man. You know, and you know, and that was by members of Alcoholics Anonymous telling me what to do, and I was taking suggestions. And I wasn't taking suggestions on my own volition. I was beaten, man. You know, if you asked me to take a suggestion, I have to see the result before I even take the suggestion, you know. And so I was doing what I was doing because I was beaten. And I got involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. Members here started dragging me around. I got involved with conferences, with the Erky Pods and the roundups, and the time went on and stuff like that. And the sobriety was great at the beginning, you know. And immediately the first few months of my sobriety, I saw what the alcohol does, could do to another human being in sobriety. And my sponsor went out. I really liked this guy. I respected him. And he went out, and the first week he went out, he came back, and he had a black eye. And he took a sponsee with him. And he had a black eye. The sponsee was scratched up. And he came back. He said, I'm going to come back in. I'm going to get involved. And the week after that, he came back with a broken arm. And it's like, fuck, you know. And then the week after that, I hadn't seen him for a while. And it's hard for him to get sober now. And I'm not talking about him. I'm just talking about the disease of alcoholism. And, you know, my sobriety for me has been a blast. One of my favorite speakers is Ken Devaney. And he speaks about being rocketed in the fourth dimension of existence. And that's exactly as I feel in my sobriety. I mean, I'm really grateful to this program. It hasn't been like the easiest ride for me in sobriety. I mean, first of all, I have teenage kids. That enough will lead you want to drink. You know, second of all, there was deaths and sobriety with friends and family. I was 2 years sober, and I, out of my rage and my anger, I knocked a guy out on Chibble Street West. And in the midst of me not knowing, I was supposed to be deported. And they had sent me deportation papers, but I never got them because I had been moving. And by the time I got to immigration, they had the letters there, thank God, that wasn't open, proving that I never really received it. And so I was living in Montreal, in Canada, for a few years, quite a few years, in sobriety, every year being under the gun that they could refuse me to stay in here. So every time around October, so I would get antsy, you know? Like, damn, they have to review this thing, take out the files and the papers, and finally that got a little bit ironed out very much. So my sobriety has been like that. I have really good friends. I remember Charlie Quinn passed away in sobriety. He was a really good friend of mine, and I had a good time. That kind of like shook me up. Bruce Tobin passed away, the priest of the Wednesday. So these kind of things kind of settled in my mind, you know. And also it's just the regular deal of, you know, of sobriety. You know, you come in here and sometimes you see other people going to slip and they come back and you start to thinking like, damn, you know, they're able to go out there and have a little bit of fun. Like, why? What the hell? If they can make it back, maybe I can make it back and do that. But I haven't had that opportunity to try and do that. And once again, this program, I believe, saved my life. I really love this program, Alcoholics Anonymous. And anybody new out here or coming back, I don't have any of the answers. You know what I'm saying? I can't tell you anything that you can't find out from somebody else. But if you stick around, get a little bit involved, you know, just be a little curious and stick with it, and you'll see, you'll get the answers that you need to get. I'd like to thank you for my sobriety, and God bless you all.